Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're kindly joined once more by Alan Green. Alan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good morning, Jonathan. Good to be back.
So we've got a packed podcast today, and we're going to be discussing numerous companies as well as some of the most important themes in markets at the moment. To start off with, though, Alan, let's go back to last week. We discussed Barclays in some detail. And at the time, we said in the following week, we will be receiving further updates from other UK banks, which we have done in the form of NatWest, Lloyds. I think we've had Standard Chartered in the last couple of days. But I think in terms of the comparisons that we should start with and make, Alan, is looking particularly at NatWest and Lloyds, because their business models are the most similar to Barclays and obviously facilitators of the UK economy as well as bellwethers for the UK economy. So very good numbers from Barclays, and it appears to be the same situation in NatWest and Lloyds. Lloyds profit up to 2 billion, NatWest up to 1.6 billion. Both had significant reversals of provisions they made for COVID coming into the profit there. So some quite sharp increases in the profits. But from what you've seen, Alan, is there a particular standout from those banks that you think investors should be looking at? Or do you think it's a case, it's a story across the same across all of them, and really they're probably going to move in the same way over the next period?
Well, I think by and large, as I said before, I mean, Barclays for me is still the pick because it's differentiated. Let's face it, it's tough to be in banking at the moment. Retail banking is a very, very low margin business to be in, and we've seen banks like Metro Bank attempt to secure a position in the UK just as a high street bank. And I think whilst it's laudable and it's great to have a community bank there, the realities are, as a commercial operation, it's very hard to make it profitable. But we've seen Barclays, of course, have done a good job, but most of their profits were driven by their investment banking arm, and historically that's always been Barclays' profile. Still trading at a big discount to net asset value, but I've been particularly impressed by Lloyds. Obviously with the dividend cap being lifted, they've reinstated the dividend, and along with a number of other companies, Lloyds historically has been a cornerstone of many a fund manager's portfolio, simply because the dividend was regular as clockwork. Then, of course, the credit crunch happened, and it's really been hard for the banks to recover since then. Could Lloyds be restored to its former glory? Too early to say, I think, but it reported a pre-tax profit of 3.9 billion compared to a 602 million loss last year at the height of the crisis, and in that it's still set a further 837 million aside for bad debts from the COVID pandemic. Revenues or net income, shall I say, rose to 7.6 billion, and the net interest margin, the difference between saving and lending rates, fell 9 basis points to 2.5%. So, slim margins again for the group, but that's a pretty healthy profit and a pretty resounding turnaround as we emerge from COVID. And as with all the banks, all of the banks are facing the onslaught of the new challengers. We've obviously got the likes of Starling and Tide out there, and with the open banking initiatives that we're going to touch on a little later as well, we've got all of these factors stacking up against the traditional bank going forward. Nonetheless, you know, Lloyds is marketing as heavily as ever. I mean, there are TV ads everywhere. The black horse is galloping across our screens, as it has done for years. And of course, after the dividend cap was lifted, the Lloyds declared a 0.67p per share dividend. So investors will be cheering the return of that. In terms of the actual performance of the stock, I mean, it's recovered very strongly from it dipped below 25p in August, September last year. And of course, we're now sitting at 46p. I am a shareholder in the company, so I will continue to hold. But it's going to be hard really to see how they're going to grow and improve from there. I think ultimately, if Lloyds can streamline their operations, offload some of their massive property portfolio, then I think we're going to see the way forward.
Fantastic. So, I mean, just one last point with the banks, Alan. I mean, is it a case that you feel that they're very tightly tied to the UK economy going forward in terms of the growth trajectory that we have? Or do you feel that there's an internal situation within the banks that they're, you know, have improvements that is going to see increases in profitability going forward, which isn't so much linked to the economy?
I think banks like Lloyds, of course, are UK focused, UK centric. So they are very much tied to the whims of the UK economy going forward. But obviously the others that we've discussed, Barclays has its global investment banking portfolio, HSBC, Standard Chartered, these are all global international banks. So they have exposure to the UK, of course, they are less reliant on the performance of the UK or a recovering UK economy to support their overall performance. But that they have a lot of, as I said, they have a lot of barriers that they face, a lot of challenges to negotiate. The challenger banks are nipping at their heels and will continue to do so. And the banks are being forced. Well, the good thing is, I think, for the consumer, the banks are being forced to evolve and modernize to keep pace with the challenges. So the technology that we're going to be seeing going forward. I mean, already with the banking apps, you know, certainly I have a Halifax app, which is, of course, Halifax are owned by Lloyds Banking now. And I've seen improvements in that. And certainly there are issues with hacking and security that are creating constant concerns. And certainly Lloyds and Halifax Banking are very much ahead of the curve on that front. And I'm just speaking from personal experience in using their app, much, much better than the NatWest app and rival apps. So I think they've certainly got a head start in that field, but time will tell.
Indeed it will. And I'm sure when we get further updates from the banking sector, it will be something we discuss on the podcast again. So, Alan, let's now move on to a theme which is, you know, slightly more global in its significance, and that's the going-ons in China over the past few months. Of course, we've been discussing in some detail COVID and how that's been impacting markets over the last year. Of course, there's no escaping the pandemic and what that's done to equities. However, you know, before that, we've always seen China as quite a big driver of markets. You know, the growth story there has been one that investors have been increasingly reliant on over the years in terms of pushing forwards global growth. But it seems now, just in the last week, Alan, that's starting now to shift from the pandemic back towards a focus on China and looking to China for growth. And we started to see some wobbles initially in oil markets. We've seen oil soften on concerns around manufacturing data coming out of China. We had the manufacturing PMIs, which is a gauge of manufacturing activity in China. that fell to 50.4 with expectations of 50.8. A reading of anything above 50 is a sign of expansion within the manufacturing sector. But of course, we're now falling down to those levels of around 50.4 to that 50 level, which would actually signify a contraction there. I mean, do you feel, Alan, that there is any weight to concerns about growth in China, or do you think that this is, you know, potentially markets just starting to move on from the pandemic, having a little look around what's happening on a global basis and saying, okay, maybe China's not as strong as we wanted it to be and what it was 3 months ago as it was recovering, and starting to see some worries there. I mean, is it going to be something that you think is quite significant for the rest of this year in terms of China's growth and how it's moving the global situation when people are paying attention to where we're going to see earnings come from over the next sort of 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, China is always a concern for any investor, John. And as you rightly said, the next 6 to 12 months, bear in mind that markets are always looking between 6 to 9 months ahead. But some facts can't be changed. I mean, China has the most enormous manufacturing industry, an enormous population, and an economy that's not only was fast growing anyway, but is recovering even faster because of the recovery from COVID and the return to some semblance of normality. I mean, you know, when you consider it imports roughly half of all the key metals that are mined, a third of all shipped crops, and nearly 20% of global ore shipments, you can see the impact that China has on the global economy. And of course, the moves to try to curb Chinese government to curb prices have really been like trying to sort of not rearrange their chairs on the Titanic, but attempts to sort of turn a super tanker around in a river. You know, it's they are extremely limited in what they can do, because as an economy, they are beholden to commodity prices. And the more they consume, effectively, the more prices can be raised. And they are very much beholden to that. But I'm sure the threat to take measures like this, and you know, if the government becomes more protectionist going forward, the very threat will take some of the froth off the prices, and of course that will impact on the commodity prices to some extent, oil prices, and also of course the prices of the underlying stocks and instruments used to trade that. But we're looking 6 to 9 months ahead. I don't think there are too many concerns at the moment. And if the next manufacturing and GDP data from China shows the growth that would seem to be taking place there, then I don't think we can have too many worries.
So throughout history, Alan, we've always seen when there's a change of major global superpowers, going back to Roman times and even before that, whenever we see a shift of the biggest power in the world, there is a form of friction. Of course, back then, you know, it was military conflicts that played out. And, you know, to some extent, I think that there's an argument now that we are seeing that between the United States and China. But opposed to it being played out on a military basis, it does seem that it's on a trade basis. And, you know, so looking at some of the moves that we've seen from China very recently, particularly targeting Chinese companies that are listed in New York. A few weeks ago now, DD listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, this is a rides hailing app, very similar to Uber, listed in New York, Chinese company. Very shortly after that, the Chinese blocked the app from being accessed, and saw a huge drop in the price of that company shortly after its IPO. And just this week, we've seen the Chinese state media calling a game operated by Tencent, a very large technology company operating in China, listed in New York. One of the popular games there, calling it Spiritual Opium, saw $60 billion drop off the value of that company in one day. This is something that has been going on ever since Trump came into power. But Alan, looking at it from a UK investor's point of view, do you think this is an issue that's very much only an issue if you're focused heavily on stocks listed in the United States and, of course, trying to invest and find opportunities in China? Or do you think this could have some spillover into UK and European equities going forwards?
Oh, it'll definitely have a spillover, John. There's no doubt about that, because as we always say, if the Dow sneezes, we catch a cold. And that's historically always been the case. That is one way that, of course, the Chinese can get some leverage on global markets by impacting on companies, on their own companies that are listed on other markets. And of course, $60 billion wiped off the valuation of a company does have a spin-over effect, because the US indices will fall, and correspondingly the UK and European indices will fall too. But those are just intraday swings, and I think any trader or market anyone in the market with a position and a portfolio is going to take a more sanguine view and probably look at the bigger picture and just look at it as a storm in a teacup, because that's all it is. I think if the Chinese were able to leverage up any further in any way at all, then it would be a concern. But they're limited to that. They are beholden, as I said, to commodity prices. But let's not also forget, China is consuming a huge amount at the moment, but also the US infrastructure itself is in dire need of redeveloping. And the Biden administration has introduced plans to reinvigorate the US infrastructure. So we're not wholly reliant on the Chinese. And I think if consumption in other markets increases, then of course that will loosen China's grip.
Indeed. That's going to be interesting to see how that story plays out in the coming months. So, Alan, let's now bring it back to the UK. And just as we started off with the banks, which I mentioned were a significant bellwether of the UK economy, we're going to now discuss a equity in Taylor Wimpey, a house builder, also a bellwether of the UK economy. Shares are up just over 3%. They've reported this morning. Alan, what does that look like?
It's a great set of numbers. Taylor Wimpey, ironically, there were a dilemma that I think weighed on the housing stocks last year has all but dissipated. Of course, there the concerns over, and we've discussed this on the podcast before, concerns over the impact of furlough schemes ending and companies unable to survive the COVID crisis, the impact that would have on house prices seems to be little more than a distant memory. House prices are as buoyant as ever, possibly inflated to some degree by the stamp duty holiday as well. But nonetheless, Taylor Wimpey has today reported a record half year, a record set of half year results with revenues of 2.2 billion, nearly tripling 2020's revenue, and still up nearly 27% on 2019. There were a number of delays in quarter four of last year, which obviously contributed to the lower numbers and figures from last year. And of course, those are spilled over into the current year. So you could argue that the numbers have been partially inflated by the those that weren't able to complete last year. But we're in a burgeoning housing market. House prices, I think are up some 10% year on year and are expected to increase going forward. and the irony is that given everything that we've looked at in the housing sector, Taylor Wimpey could be one of the COVID's biggest winners, ironically. It also, during the pandemic, embarked on an aggressive land buying strategy. So it's got land that it can still build on. So it's got visibility going forward, scope for further sales. And it seems to be building from a very strong base. And of course, from investors, there's an interim dividend of just over 4p per share, which will be very, very welcome. And the company said that looking forward, completions are expected to come in near the top end of guidance, with operating profits expected to be about 820 million, again, beating expectations from analysts comfortably. So, Taylor Wimpey, you know, along with a lot of other housing companies, looks to be in an extremely strong position.
I mean, do you think that the housing trends that we're starting to see in the UK, where it's becoming apparent central London and other cities are seeing somewhat downside pressure in some of the sort of key areas that traditionally have been associated with people, working within the city, as they start to move out? It's a sort of concept of outgration with some house buyers sort of moving into the country. Do you think that a house builder like Taylor Wimpey is particularly well placed to benefit from that? Obviously, with a countrywide portfolio of properties typically outside of city centres, do you think this is something that they can see further benefit from going forward for the rest of 2021?
Certainly, and I think this is where Taylor Wimpey's aggressive land buying strategy during the lockdown has or will start to pay off. And let's not forget, I mean, a lot of people buying houses have saved huge amounts of cash during lockdown because we'd not been able to go out and spend money at the pub or in the cinema. So people that have been at home and own houses will have been spending money on home improvements. So we've seen bumper years for the DIY stores like Kingfisher, of course, B&Q, and of course for the builders merchants too. Those that didn't own houses will have saved large amounts of cash and will be in a very strong position when it comes to purchasing houses in the coming year. So I think Taylor Wimpey have got it both ways, and of course other house builders too. So there may be, you may want to look around and take a look at some other operators in the sector that maybe are or haven't yet reported and could well be in the same position.
Yes, and as we get further updates from the house builders, it's going to be interesting to see how they perform given the slightly different mix across the house builders of where their portfolio of properties are. So that's going to be interesting to see how they all perform. So moving on now, Alan, to the final company that we are going to discuss today. Now, this is one that listeners will be familiar with if they listened to the podcast last week. We had Jonathan Rowland, who is the chairman of Mode PLC, but there's been a lot happening since then, Alan, with the company that specialises in Bitcoin and open banking. What's been the latest updates from them?
Okay, so Mode, of course, came to market last year, IPO'd in October 2020, and with a focus on bringing payment and loyalty industries into the next generation financial ecosystem. And I mentioned when we spoke about Lloyds earlier, I mentioned the open banking initiative, and Mode is right at the forefront of that. And I was interested when the company first came to market, and I actually downloaded their app and use their app regularly, and it's extremely good. So the company set up the app to enable users to use Bitcoin to make purchases, and also to introduce crypto, Bitcoin and crypto into the commercial sector by way of payment systems and payment initiatives. So it's had a busy few months. In June, of course, it announced it partnered with THG PLC for payment launch across 30 brands, and these brands include My Protein and Look Fantastic. And the great thing about the Mode app is it's seamless instant payment. And I've gone in and bought Bitcoin numerous times, and I basically make the purchase. It goes into my, it automatically opens my Halifax app. I transfer the money in, and the deal is done, and it takes seconds. It's a very good app, and it's very user friendly. Compared to a lot of other apps in the area, I like the way it operates. But the company's took a significant step at the end of June when it secured the EMI license. That's the electronic money institution license, and of course AMLD5, the FCA license, which basically means that they've built an extremely secure and compliant platform, and it's one of a handful of companies to be granted both those accreditations, and it's the only one listed on the UK markets. Then at the end of June, it launched a payment and reward system across Android platforms, frictionless payments, and instant Bitcoin cashback. Earlier in the year, Mode launched a Bitcoin jar, so it meant users could actually earn interest on Bitcoin on deposit. Bear in mind that Bitcoin is the default treasury currency for Mode. It's actually changed the Bitcoin jar into a payments and rewards system now. So if you make payments or you buy goods and services using your Mode app with Bitcoin, you'll earn loyalty rewards and payments on the way through. Then at the end of July, last week, in fact, it launched the payment reward system on the iOS system. So again, an identical platform, but for iOS. And at the end of last week, announced its first charity donation partnership with Young Lives Versus Cancer. So making huge headway, very much at the forefront of the open finance, and open banking initiative. The company is currently worth 45 million, got a market cap 45 million, trading today at 49p. We've seen it touch as high as 78p at the start of the year. But certainly it's put down a floor at around 42, 43p over the past three to 4 months, and we're now seeing it move towards the top of the recent trading range. So I think a great future, and we're going to see a lot more from the company as the second half of the year progresses.
So this is always a question that I've had with similar companies that are operating in Bitcoin, and one that I think we've discussed before earlier on this year. Of course, their business is operating payments facilitated by Bitcoin. But how much do you think the future revenue generation and profitability, and therefore shareholder value, is linked to what the price of Bitcoin does? And how much of it is down to what the actual business does in terms of bringing on new customers, offering new services? You know, how far is the sort of balance between those two weighted towards the price of Bitcoin? Or, you know, could we see a situation where indeed Bitcoin crashes down to 5,000, but we actually do see businesses like Mode really push on and produce shareholder returns going forward?
Well, of course, Mode has adopted Bitcoin as its treasury reserve unit and holds at least 10% of its cash reserves in Bitcoin. So it is inevitable that the share price will be subject in some ways to the vagaries and movements of Bitcoin. Of course, we've seen it drop. We saw it drop substantially over the past few months, and there's been a minor recovery recently, but it's still well down. But during the time, Mode is rapidly developing its app. You know, it's a one wallet solution. So all the transactions that will take place through the payment solution that Mode provides to commercial entities and retailers, Mobile Earn every time a transaction goes through its one of its apps and platforms. So to that end, it's going to gain more and more exposure to simply earning money, like a bank does, from every transaction that goes through. So as time progresses, of course, it will become less reliant on Bitcoin. But the other factor is that, of course, the governments around the world, including the US Fed, are clearly stating that they are moving towards having a central government cryptocurrency. And I think this is going to be, it's really given, if you like, Bitcoin the credibility that we'd always hoped. And of course, CBDCs going forward are going to be key to the strength of cryptocurrencies, and that of course includes Bitcoin, Ethereum, and some of the smaller ones. So Mode's future is very much based on evolving into a new open bank, if you like, earning money from every transaction that comes through a system. But in the interim, certainly it's one of the best places and the easiest places to buy, sell, and hold Bitcoin that I know.
Yes, and certainly some exciting additions to their product range there. So I think this is going to be one of the companies, having spoken to Jonathan Rowland last week, to watch in the crypto space going forward for the rest of this year. And as we start to see this crypto story develop and become more mainstream in the future. So just as a recap on the equities that we've discussed today, at the beginning we touched on the banks again and focused particularly on Lloyds and NatWest. Lloyds trades under the ticker of LLOY. NatWest, formerly RBS, but now trades under the ticker of NWG. We then discussed the house builder Taylor Wimpey with the ticker of TW, and just then was Mode, which trades under the ticker of MODE. Alan, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks again, Jonathan.
So just as a note for anybody listening, if you want to know more about Mode, do go back through the list of podcasts and check out the one we did, I think it was about a week ago now, with Jonathan Rowland from Mode. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.